Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Richard Feetcham. I am Professor of Global Health at the University of California, San Francisco and Berkeley, and Director of the Global Health Group at UCSF. I am your moderator for today's program. Let me start by briefly setting the global context for our discussion. In all wealthy countries, healthcare is the largest industry, consuming more of the national income than either defense or education. Within the US, healthcare consumes a staggering 17% of gross national product, or roughly $7,000 per citizen per year. This is twice as much as in any European country. In every wealthy country, healthcare is politically contentious and contested. But nowhere are these debates as polarized and as fierce as we see today in the United States. In every wealthy country, the public debate on healthcare policy and healthcare reform tends to be wildly ill-informed. But in no country has this debate descended to the level of absurdity that we currently experience here in the US. Recent accusations of death committees are a good example of this descent into absurdity. In every wealthy country, powerful vested interests seek to maintain the status quo. However, nowhere is the battle for profit fought so viciously and unscrupulously as in the United States. And lastly, and most shamefully, no other wealthy country in the world permits a situation in which tens of thousands of its citizens die unnecessarily each year purely because they are uninsured or underinsured. It is in this context that we follow daily the battle in Congress, the battle in the media, and the battle for the hearts and minds of the American people concerning President Obama's plans for health care reform. And so it is with great pleasure and great anticipation that I introduce today's distinguished speaker, T.R. Reid, Washington Post correspondent, NPR commentator, and author of a superb new book, The Healing of America, a Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. This afternoon's discussion is clearly timely, and I have no doubt that it will also be lively and informative. Please join me in welcoming T.R. Reid.
Hi, everybody. Thank you, Professor Feetcham. I got to say, if you're an ink-stained journalist who stumbles into the world of health policy and then you meet one of the titans of the field, Richard Feetcham, that's pretty formidable. And then to have him say my book is good, that's even better. So thank you very much. It's marvelous for me to be in this great, great city and in this famous venue. I could go on a long time about how thrilled I am to be here, but they only gave me 30 minutes, so I'm going to skip all that part. I will say, you know, I live in Colorado, and we're pretty proud of our beautiful state. In fact, I think the rule is in Colorado, they yank your driver's license if you dare say any other state is as pretty as Colorado. But yesterday, I rented a bike and rode across the Golden Gate Bridge up to the Marin Headlands, and I think I can safely say there's no bike ride like that in all of Colorado. It was fabulous. I'm here to talk about my new book, and here's what happens in this new book. I set out to answer a question that's pretty important for Americans, and that is, how come all the other advanced, industrialized, free market democracies, countries just like us, managed to provide health care for everybody of high quality and still spend half as much as we do. How do they do that? And I went around the world trying to figure that out. And you know what? I think I got it. I think I nailed this in the book. But along the way, I figured out there was another question that's frankly just as important, and that is, why do they do it? Why would a country commit to provide health care for all its people? And if you think about that one for about 5 minutes, it leads to another pretty obvious question. Why doesn't the world's richest country provide health care for everybody who needs it? How come we've never made this commitment? And in the book, as I said, I deal with those three questions. I think I get to the how they do it. I think I figured out why the other countries do it. I still can't figure out why we don't do it. I really struggle with that in the book. So here's what I'm going to do today. I'm just going to go very quickly, because they only gave me half an hour, you know, to through what I learned when I went around the world to see these other healthcare systems and tell you what I found. And I'm a reporter. I like to be honest. I'll be totally upfront with you. I have a hidden agenda here. Here's the hope. The hope is that you will hear this very quick overview and say, boy, that stuff is so interesting. I wonder if there's a book I could buy about that. First of all, I want to tell you what I didn't find when I went overseas, and this arguably is just as important for Americans. In the first place, it's not all socialized medicine in other countries. As a matter of fact, many countries, many rich countries, provide health care for everybody with private doctors, private hospitals, and private insurance plans. In fact, in about 5 minutes, I'm going to argue to you that many of the other rich democracies are less socialized than the United States of America. Second, it's not all single payer. Single payer healthcare systems work. They're efficient and they tend to be fair. They work fine, but it doesn't have to be single payer. Japan has 3,000 payers. Great health results and half the cost that we do. Germany has 220 payers. Switzerland is about the size of the Bay Area in population, 70 different payers. So it doesn't have to be single payer. And a third thing that's interesting is they don't all do it the same. The notion that you go overseas and everything is big government nanny state and they do everything, no, it's not true. All the other developed countries have faced the same questions and the same decisions that we face. And guess what? They've all come up with different answers. For example, in this book of mine, I talk about which countries cover Viagra as part of the basic plan. You know, if they include Viagra in their official formulary, then it's very cheap or free. And if they don't, you got to pay through the nose for this pill. And it's kind of interesting, the results. Now, for example, we lived in Britain and we're on the National Health System, National Health Service, which is a good system but fairly stingy. There's a lot of stuff they don't cover. But they cover Viagra. Now, why would that be? Yeah, I know what you're thinking. No, that's not it. It turns out a British scientist invented Viagra and they're proud of this guy. So they're going to put his pill on their formulary. But you go 25 miles away across the channel to France, and France doesn't list Viagra in its basic formulary. And I was in the health ministry in Paris, and you know, I'm a reporter. I have this checklist of questions, and I'm just going down. So I said to this woman in the health ministry, how come your formulary doesn't cover Viagra? The French men, they do not need a Viagra. So they all tend to be different. Different cultural and historic traditions influence every country's healthcare system. But here's the deal. There are about 190 countries in the world, and the good news for my publisher is you don't have to go to 190 countries to see how healthcare works overseas, because I have lumped them into categories, and I'm going to tell you four main models of healthcare around the world. And I just want to say, this may be to your benefit. Different healthcare economists see different models, and one famous healthcare economist sees 16 different models around the world. But, you know, I'm a journalist. I like to make these things easy. So I'm going to tell you four models of healthcare around the world. And here's what I want you to listen for. I want you to listen for who the providers of healthcare are, docs, hospitals, drug companies, and who the payer is. You got that? Okay, so we're going to start in Great Britain with the Beveridge model of healthcare. This is named for Lord William Beveridge, who was kind of a classic British type. He was born to a ton of money, titled gentry, born to a title, and guess what? He spent his entire life helping the downtrodden on the streets of East London. He just devoted his life to that. Along the way, he also started the London School of Economics. Pretty interesting fellow, but kind of a classic British type, the rich, lefty, social reformer. And they show up now and then. And here's what happened. As World War II was winding down and it became clear to Winston Churchill that Britain was and America were going to defeat the Nazis, win the war, Churchill started thinking about what Britain should look like in the second half of the 20th century, and he hired Lord Beveridge to write a report on British social services. And Beveridge proposed a system that's now called the National Health Service, and on this Beveridge model of healthcare is the government's job. It's just like the fire department or the public library or the parks. When you need the service, you take it and you don't pay. You pay in taxes, but you don't pay on the scene. Most people in Britain, France, Italy, New Zealand also have this model, go their entire lives and never get a doctor bill, never get a hospital bill. They think that's normal. And in this system, because government pays for everything, taxes are high to pay for this. But as a matter of fact, since nobody in Britain is paying the $600 or $800 a month for health insurance, they net out better. In fact, they pay half as much for health care as we do, and yet the system covers everybody. In this model, the British government owns almost all the hospitals. It employs not all, but many of the doctors. And the government, as I said, pays all the bills. So if government is the provider and the payer, I think I'd call that socialized medicine, wouldn't you? I'm not sure our politicians know what they're talking about when they complain about socialized medicine, but that looks pretty close to me. But now we're going to go across the channel to the European mainland, and we're going to see a different model that's kind of a mirror image of Beveridge. And this is the Bismarck model of healthcare because it was invented by the first German chancellor, Otto von Bismarck. He was the chancellor of Prussia, and in 1871, he unified about two dozen German-speaking fiefdoms and principalities into a nation called Germany. And he had to convince, his big job for Bismarck was to convince the Bavarians and the Alsatians and the Wiesbadens that they really belong to a new country called Germany. And to do it, he created a lot of bennies, a lot of benefits coming out of Berlin that people got from this new government of Germany. In 1873, he invented old age pensions paid by the government. We call that Social Security. We got to it in 1935. He invented workman's compensation. If you got hurt on the job, the government paid to treat you. And in 1883, Bismarck created the world's first national health care system on the argument that a government has a responsibility to care for people's health. But he did it not through government. He decided to do it through private insurance plans, and the model was everybody bought insurance through the employer, and you split the premium between the worker and the employer. Does this sound familiar? To this day, 155 million Americans are on the Bismarck model of healthcare. And it's used in Germany, France, Belgium, Switzerland, Netherlands, Japan, and some other countries. It works fine. They cover everybody, and their costs are significantly less than America's. But remember, the docs are private. The hospitals are private, and the insurance plans are private. They're nonprofit, but they're private. That's not socialism. Japan has more for-profit hospitals than the United States. In America, when people turn 65, just about everybody goes to government-run health insurance, Medicare. In Germany, people stay with the private insurer cradle to grave. This is not socialism. You with me on this? My third model is kind of a blend of those two. And this I call this the National Health Insurance model, the NHI model. And in this system, the providers, the docs, the hospitals, the labs, are private, for-profit, and the payer is government. The insurance system is government. And the paradigm case here is Canada. Canada has a system where everybody pays a premium to the provincial government, and you go to the doctor for free. The bill's paid for by the system. And guess what they call it? They invented this in 1944, and you know what they call it? Medicare. And when Lyndon Johnson decided in 1965 to provide government health insurance to all American seniors, he took the model and the name from Canada. Private providers and public payers. And this is a good system. This is used in Canada, in Australia, Taiwan, South Korea, a lot of newly rich countries that have just instituted healthcare systems in the last 10 years or so have adopted the Canadian model, and Mexico is doing it as of January, and I think theirs is going to be Canadian model too. In my book, did I mention my book? In my book, I'm pretty tough on Canada. My chapter on Canada is titled Sorry to Keep You Waiting. Because what they did up there was, in order to save money, they've limited the number of specialists and operating rooms and scanning machines. And therefore, if you have a problem that's not acute, that's not emergency, they keep you waiting. They do this to save money. Look, Canada, to me, it's good care. If you're sick, an ambulance comes to your house for free. You go to the hospital for free. The follow-up care is free. They take care of people. Nobody dies in Canada for lack of treatment. But people go for a long time with painful shoulders or knees in Canada because they keep you waiting. And in my case, I've got this bum shoulder, and I took my shoulder around the world with me when I did this study. And I said to this wonderful doctor in Canada, look, my shoulder only goes this high. I need help. And he said, yeah, I have to refer you to a orthopedic surgeon. It's a gatekeeper system. You need a referral. Yeah, fine. He said, I'll write you a letter. And I said, how long will it take? He said, 10 or 12 months. 12 months. My shoulder hurts every day when I wake up. I got to go 12 months to get it treated. And he said, I didn't say treated. No, it'll be 12 months for the first consultation. It'd be another 5 or 6 months after that if he wants to treat you. And so I was talking to somebody in Canada in the Canadian healthcare system, Canadian health ministry. They're smugly superior to us because they know they cover everybody. And this guy says to me, yeah, you know, you let thousands of people die and go bankrupt. We cover everybody in our country. And I said, well, come on. I got a sore shoulder. In your country, it would take me a year just to see the doctor. How can you brag about that? And here's what he said. He said, yes, we do keep people waiting for non-emergency care. But you got to know something about Canadians. He says, for Canadians, we don't mind waiting that much as long as the rich Canadian and the poor Canadian have to wait about the same amount of time. Now, there is a national ethic of health care in that one sentence. And it's not our ethic. It's not what we see for health care. So that's three models. Now, the fourth model is the most common one in the world. It's found in about 140 of the world's 190 countries because it's only rich countries that have any health care system at all. In all the other countries, the model is known as the out-of-pocket model, and it's simple. If your child is sick and you have some money in your pocket to pay the doctor, she gets treated. If you don't have any money, she stays sick or dies. It's simple, it's brutal, and it's a fact of life in much of the world. It's not always money. People pay in whatever they've got. They pay in potatoes. They weave a rug for the hospital, things like that. I took a hike in northern Nepal. I hiked up where there are no roads. I hiked up maybe an hour and a half, a very steep trail up to the top of this hill. And there on the top of the hill is this squat, you know, plainest little stucco rectangular building you've ever seen, like an outhouse or something, a little bigger, except every wall was a different color. So I'm in there talking to the doctor, and he treats people in this poor country. How do people pay you? And he says, well, I eat a lot of potatoes, you know. And that chair over there, somebody made for me in his shop and brought it up on his back up the road. And he said, and a lot of people tell me that they don't have any money, but they have some paint at home, so they'll pay me by painting the clinic, and they all have a different color. So that's the out-of-pocket model. And I went around the world for years to find the four models that I've just told you. And here's the secret. Please don't tell my publisher who paid for this trip. I didn't have to do that because you can find every one of them right here in the United States. We've got them all. If you're a Native American or a veteran or active duty military, well, then you live in Britain for healthcare purposes. That's government doctors and government hospitals, no bills. That's the NHS right there in the United States. If you're over 65 and on Medicare, well, you live in Canada for healthcare purposes, private providers and a government insurance plan. If you're a working person getting health insurance with the employer and you split the cost of the premium with the employer, you live in Germany. That's the Bismarck model. It used to be, just 2 years ago, about 170 million Americans were on it. So many people have lost their jobs and so many employers have dropped coverage that it's now about 155 million Americans are on the Bismarck model. And if you're one of the 40-some million Americans with no coverage, well, then, for healthcare purposes, you live in Afghanistan or Angola. Those people are living in the out-of-pocket model right here in the richest country in the world. And this is why, as Professor Feachum told us, tens of thousands of Americans die each year because they can't afford to see a doctor. We meet one of them on the first page of my book. We let that happen. So we've got them all. That's the fundamental difference, the biggest difference between the United States and the other countries is all the other countries have decided on one system for everybody. Maybe there's, you know, socialized medicine. Maybe it's an NHS model, a British model. Maybe it's all private like Britain or Netherlands or Switzerland or Japan. But everybody's in. Some countries have a military medical corps, and when the soldiers are overseas, if they get sick or get shot, a military doctor treats them, but as soon as that British lieutenant goes home from Afghanistan, she's in the NHS with everybody else. And during the 2008 campaign, John McCain, the Republican candidate, complained about this bitterly. Well, we don't want to be like other countries. They have one-size-fits-all medicine. They treat everybody the same. That would never work in America. So when I was traveling the world, I went to all the health ministries, and I asked every health minister, why do you have one-size-fits-all medicine? Well, while I was writing this book, I made a couple of films for PBS Frontline about the book, and that helped a lot because, you know, in European countries, and frankly in East Asia too, the public broadcaster is the big broadcaster, you know, much more powerful than the commercial network. So if you go to Europe and say, I'm doing a film for American PBS, you know, they think you're NBC or something, you know, they think you're really important. So I went to Switzerland and said, I'm from PBS, could I talk to your health minister? And the Swiss said, American PBS, talk to our president, you know, which I did. And I asked them, why do you have everybody in the same system? And they gave me three answers, and I will let you judge whether these make sense to you. First of all, it's just so much simpler and cheaper as an administrative matter if there's one set of forms and one set of rules, and many countries have one set of prices. You go to the doctor in France, and on the wall, she's required by law to have a list of the price of every procedure she does. The next column tells you how much your insurance plan's going to pay you back. It's usually 80%. And the next column tells you how many days, it's days, before insurance pays you. Now, no American doctor could post that. We don't know because it's so expensive and so complicated. And you can see the results. America's for-profit, free enterprise, private insurance companies have administrative costs in the range of 18 to 25%. They report this to the government. They add 20% to every doctor bill they pay. Now, in other countries, anybody here think of France as a model of management efficiency? In France, the insurance industry has administrative costs of 4%, one-fifth as much as the Stanford MBAs running America's health insurance companies. That's a key, because everybody's in one system. And even if they have multiple payers like Japan, they have a unified system with one set of rules. And look what you get out of it. Second, if everybody's in one system, cradle to grave, then that system has a real strong economic incentive to provide preventive health care. Public health endeavors, preventive health, it definitely reduces suffering. It extends lives. There's no doubt about that, but it's expensive. Public health is costly, and you need an incentive to spend the money. Well, in the American health care system, most people stay with one insurance company on average. The average is 4.8 years. That insurance company, which has to pay a profit to its investors, It would be stupid for them to waste money on keeping you healthy. By the time you get sick, you're the next guy's problem. I mean, a lot of those latent diseases won't show up till you're 66 and you're on Medicare. You're the government's problem. You with me? In the other countries, they worry about you because they're going to have you for life. And I argue in my book that the world champion at preventive health care is Great Britain. How many people here have lived there? Professor Feacham has. I felt in Britain, you know, you walk down the street and there's a big sign. Do your feet hurt? Call this 800 number. We'll send a podiatrist free. And the reason is it may be a sign of incipient diabetes. They want to catch that early. And also, they don't want your feet to hurt. They have this TV ad where mom is cooking dinner in a big pot, and you can just see it's one of those disgusting British dinners like porridge, you know, or Marmite or something. And the kids are saying, mom, where's dinner? And mom says, oh, don't worry. just a second. And then the announcer says, is mom coughing a lot? Could be chronic bronchitis. Call this number and we'll send a nurse free. This is what they do. You walk down Oxford Street, that's the Fifth Avenue of London, in October, November, and I used to see these pretty young girls in American cheerleader outfits, you know, the pleated skirt and pom-poms, you know, and the Brits find that really sexy, you know. So do I. And I would go, you go up to these American cheerleader types and say, what are you cheering for? And she'd say, have you had your flu jab? Have you had your flu jab? Have you had a flu shot? No. Well, go right in that door. It's free. It's free. Of course it's free. This is Britain. It's free. And I once said to the health minister of Britain, who was John Reid at the time, boy, I like living in your country because I feel that a whole bunch of people are working really hard to keep me healthy. And he said to me, isn't it obvious? Of course I'm going to do that. Here's what he said. He said, from the time the line turns blue on your mother's pregnancy test until the time you flatline in my hospital 90 years later, you're my patient. Of course I want to keep you healthy. You see, there's an economic incentive for preventive health. And then the third reason that they think everybody should be in the same system with the same rules is they think it's fairer. They think it's fairer if everybody has the same access to the same care at the same cost. Now, with that explanation, my speech to you is taking a whole new turn here, because up to now, I've really tried to be an objective reporter. I'm really trying to tell you what's good and what's bad, what works and what doesn't work in other countries. But when you get to a term like fairer or decent or ethical or humane or just, that's not the realm of objective reporting anymore. These are subjective judgments. These are moral judgments. And you know what? The number one lesson I learned traveling the world looking at healthcare systems is that fundamentally in every country, healthcare reflects a country's moral values. The design of any country's healthcare system, obviously it involves medical issues, economic questions, political questions, we're seeing that. But fundamentally, it's a moral question. Do you feel that a rich society has an obligation to provide health care to everybody who needs it? And countries that make that moral commitment then design a system like the ones I saw in Canada, in Britain, in France, Germany, Japan, that cover everybody. And if you don't make that moral commitment, if you're a country like the United States that really never even has that argument, then you may end up with a system where certain people with good insurance or a lot of money get the finest health care and the finest facilities with no waiting, and tens of millions of others never even get in the door. That's the system we've ended up with. And my fundamental argument in this book is, I thought I was writing a book about how. How do they do it? And I said, I think I got that. But the more important question is why. Why would a country commit to provide health care for everybody, or why haven't we? And to me, that's what we've first got to do. If we're going to fix our health care problem, we first have to resolve this moral question, decide whether or not we want to make that commitment. And I'm now going to summarize for you. I can summarize my book in one sentence. This does not give you a pass against buying the book. My publisher spent a lot of money sending me around the world. But here's the point. If we Americans could find the political will to cover everybody, if we had the will, all the other countries could show us the way. Thank you.
Well, our thanks to T.R. Reid, Washington Post correspondent and author of the new book, The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. It's now time for our question and answer session. And while T.R. has been speaking, we have had many questions come forward, a very rich array of questions. And let's try and get through as many of those in the question time as we can. And let me start by asking you, has President Obama read the book, and should it be compulsory reading for all members of Congress before they vote?
Well, I would say compulsory buying, certainly. I think it is starting to infiltrate policy circles in Washington, I believe. I'm going to Washington in October and talking to the policy types. I tell you what happened. As I said, I made a couple of films for PBS Frontline. They made movies of me reporting this book. One of them is Sick Around the World, which kind of covers some of the same material that I just told you, but not in as great detail as the book, believe me. Anyway, I've known Max Baucus for quite a long time. He's the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. And he had me come make a presentation on my film and my book to the Finance Committee. And all 16 members showed up on a Monday, which is pretty unusual in Washington. And I made the pitch, and I told him just what I told you in the first place. This is mainly a moral question, and if you don't make the moral commitment, we won't get there. They all seemed to get that, Republicans and Democrats. They all got that. Another point that comes through very clearly in my book is in these countries that have private health insurance, and I named them for you, many of them, there's an interesting rule, and that is health insurance has to be nonprofit. All the other countries have decided, look, docs, hospitals, drug companies, labs, they can be for profit, but all the other countries have decided that the payment system has to be nonprofit, because there's a conflict between paying for people's health care and paying a dividend to investors. It's pretty obvious. I won't go through it. Anyway, that comes through very clearly in the book. And one of the senators said to me, it's very clear that all the other countries have decided that health insurance should be nonprofit. Could you please tell us how we should convince American insurance companies to give up their profit? Yeah. And I, of course, said, hey, I'm just a reporter. You're the politicians. But what I pointed out was in Switzerland had American-style for-profit insurance until 1994. And, of course, the companies wouldn't cover anybody with a pre-existing condition. They had thousands of people denying claims. Does this sound familiar? And the Swiss decided this was not acceptable. This was not really health insurance. So they had a national referendum, passed a law that said they have to cover everybody and pay every claim, and they took the profit out of basic health insurance. Companies can't make a profit. In other words, it can be done, but the way they did it was they ran against the insurance companies. People didn't like their insurance companies. People had claims denied, and they ran against them and beat them politically. And when I said that, man, these 16 U.S. senators backed off in terror, you know. Do you know how much money those people put into our system? There was one guy, Sherrod Brown, who's an old labor lefty from Ohio, and Sherrod said, yeah, let's nail those guys, you know. Let's get... But everybody else was afraid of that. So, I hope to have some impact. I haven't had any impact that I know of on the policy people, but maybe we will.
Well, certainly, I think your book is so good that you will have a policy impact. Now, two of our questioners take on this central moral dilemma. One of them points out that Americans generally have good values, so why isn't this debate framed in a moral context? And the other questioner on a similar theme asks why people don't know this, why people don't know that 22,000 people die each year from treatable and preventable causes because they're uninsured or underinsured. And is the media playing its role in making people aware of this particular situation?
Yeah, I think those are excellent questions. Look, I have a whole chapter in my book where I struggle with this question of why haven't we ever made the commitment to cover everybody. I don't think it's because we're cruel people. I think Americans are pretty generous and they care about their neighbors. And I do conclude that it's ignorance. I think Americans don't know how cruel and how harsh our system is. And if we did, you know, if you read my book, you can see I go through the person, sometimes two people, but you can find the leader who led each of the other countries to universal health care. And I go through those stories because I'm a journalist, and journalists like people better than graphs, you know, so I do that. But you need a leader. You need a leader to constantly remind people that this is fundamentally a moral question. As for Americans don't know these facts, I think that's true. But now there's a book about it, so maybe we'll get somewhere.
Now, one of our listeners challenges your basic premise on the moral question. And he or she writes, "Our hospitals will not turn away sick people. They are treated, even if they don't have a dime and are uninsured. How can you say people have no coverage? It's false."
Some hospitals do treat anybody who shows up, but as a matter of fact, in my book, I quote the leading legal textbook on medical law in the United States, and it says in there very clearly, hospitals are not required to treat anybody who can't show proof of payment unless they're dying. You have to be either on the brink of death or in active labor, and that's why the relevant federal bill is called EMTALA, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act. So, no, hospitals don't treat everybody who shows up, at least not for free. And anyway, going to the emergency room doesn't do it. If you have lupus, for example, a disease that is manageable with drugs but requires constant study, you can't go in there for the drug for the blood test you need, for the heart test you need. You can't go to the emergency room for that. If you have diabetes, you can't go in there to get the medication you need. People are walking around in our country with ovarian cancer. They can't go in to the emergency room for the CA-125 blood test. You just don't get the care you need by going to the emergency room. It's true. If people are dying, hospitals treat them for free, and it happens all the time, and it costs all of us a lot of money. But no, it is not a substitute for real health care. You know, I talked to a doctor in Columbus, Ohio. He had worked in the casualty ward. That's what they call the ER in Britain. And now he's in an ER in Columbus, Ohio. So what's the difference? He said, well, there are a couple of differences. He said, when people come in with an appendectomy in Britain, you know, they went to the doctor when their abdomen started to hurt, and it's not that bad, and you can take out the appendix. In Columbus, Ohio, they show up with a burst appendix, and many of them die because they couldn't go to a doctor before. He said in Britain he never had an 18-year-old come in 7 inches dilated and ready to give birth who had not seen a doctor before. Happens all the time. So, no, going to the doctor, even though hospitals do treat people, it is not a substitute for health care. That's not accurate.
Now, a couple of people in the audience are concerned about the current debate on illegal immigrants within the healthcare reform discussions. One writes, "One upsetting and unedifying debate in recent weeks in the U.S. has been about whether America should offer health insurance to undocumented immigrants." And he goes on to say, or she goes on to say, "I'm a British physician. Britain never asks patients to prove their citizenship as part of their NHS treatment. What is your view on the ugly debate about immigrants?"
She's right. All the other look, a lot of countries are upset about illegal immigrants. All over Europe, this is a big issue. Most of the democracies in the world now have a nationalist party like Tom Tancredo, you know, anti-immigrant politicians, and, you know, they don't win elections, but they don't do badly. There are a lot of politicians in other countries saying, put up the fence, keep them out. But once they're in, they give them medical treatment. If an illegal alien breaks his leg on the street, they treat him. If his kid, you know, gets a bad cold, they treat him. They don't leave him out untreated. Those are two separate realms. Health care is a right in those countries, and you get it whether you're in the country legally or not. So no other country has melded those two into a single issue like we have.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is T.R. Reid, Washington Post correspondent and NPR commentator, and he's discussing healthcare systems around the world and their implications for the U.S. healthcare reform. We have a number of questions that have come in about Medicare, and their general gist is, if Medicare is an efficient and well-running system, why does the solution not lie in expanding Medicare to cover people of all ages?
To me, that's not a bad solution. It would work, I think. The problems facing Medicare, well, in the first place, you know, it only applies to the population that gets the sickest. People over 65 are the most expensive medical population in any country. And unlike the other countries where everybody's in a system, so that you have a bunch of young people paying premiums and not going to the doctor, Medicare, by definition, is limited to the people who need health care the most. So it's going to be, it's going to have financial problems. But the other issue with Medicare is, look, it's shot through with inefficiencies. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this study called the Dartmouth Atlas. These two professors at Dartmouth spent 20 years going through mountains of Medicare billing records. And guess what? It turns out that, for example, in Miami, for the average Medicare person, the average citizen over 65, medical bills total $17,000 a year. In Denver, average medical bills for people over 65 total $6,000 a year, one-third as much. And guess what? People in Denver are just as healthy as people in Florida. So there's a ton of waste and inefficiency in the system. Medicare knows it. Why haven't they done anything? Because congressmen protect the inefficient hospital and the high-billing doctors in their community. So there are really serious political strains. Medicare for all would work and would probably lead to a lot of savings, but we'd have to make some fairly tough political decisions that, frankly, Medicare has not made to date.
Couple of questions about the public option, which is much in the news these days. What's your view on the essentialness or otherwise of including a public option in the reforms?
Well, no other country that has health insurance has a public option. They don't need it because they get the same place by regulation. The point of the public option is to force the private insurers by threat of competition to stop doing some of the cruel and wasteful things they do now. But you don't need that if you regulate the insurance companies. So in these other countries, Germany, France, Netherlands, Switzerland, Japan that I mentioned in the Bismarck model, get this, the insurance companies have to cover everybody. They can't turn you down. I told you they have to pay every claim. They usually have to pay every claim pretty fast. In Switzerland, they have to pay your health insurance claim in 5 days or next month's premium is free. Anybody here have an insurance company like that? In Germany, you can choose any of 220 health insurance companies. If you don't like your company, you can drop it on 60 days' notice, and the new guy can't raise your rates. Nobody in America has that kind of choice. And as I said, the other countries have really strict controls on administrative costs, and they don't allow profit. If you have that set of regulation in the United States, health insurance would work fine. And one thing that's happened, because the health insurance companies are so afraid of a public option, because these great, you know, free enterprise, high efficiency business types are afraid of competing with federal bureaucrats, they have agreed to a lot of regulation already that they would never have accepted before. They haven't gone far enough. They haven't agreed to pay every claim. They won't agree to any limit on their administrative costs. in California. You had a bill 2 years ago, it was called Arnold Care, that said their administrative costs couldn't be more higher than 15% of premiums. That is, they had to spend 85% of their premiums on people's medical bills. And the insurance company said, no, my God, that's socialism. That's unthinkable. And they killed the bill. But that kind of limit would work. So you don't need a public option if you have the kind of regulation of private insurers that we see in other countries.
Let's take on the big question, which a number of people in the audience have raised, which I would summarize as, how do we get from A to B? In your book, you've described a very dysfunctional system that is well behind the standards set by other wealthy countries. Congress is debating how to reform that system in a context of massive lobbying and massive vested interest against change. So what prospects do you see that we will have a reform that is sufficient to address the dysfunctions that your book so well describes?
Yeah, I'm kind of pessimistic about what's gone on in Washington. I don't think this summer was fruitful for people like me who believe in universal coverage. And I don't think we're going to get it out of Washington this fall. I'm sure they'll pass a bill, and I'm sure the Democrats will declare victory. But I don't think it'll get us anywhere near the standard of health care for everybody that we see in the other rich countries. So how are we going to get there? Well, you don't want to hear me say this, but in my book, I definitely explain this because I have a chapter in there about Canada. As I said, Canada is a pretty good system. It covers everybody. It spends half as much as we do. They do keep people waiting, although that's not a function of the system. Taiwan and Korea, using the same system, have shorter waiting times than the United States. But here's what happened in Canada. That national Medicare system started in 1944 in one state, in one province. They elected this lefty guy who called himself a socialist to be their governor. They call him premier. And he set up a state-run single-payer system. Everybody paid a premium. He didn't call it a tax, a premium, to the government of Saskatchewan, and anybody in that province could go to the doctor for free. And it really worked. A lot of doctors kind of flocked there because they knew they'd get paid, and it worked fine. The system worked fine. And other provinces saw this and copied it. This is what the economists call the demonstration effect. One state made it work, and the others saw it. And by 1961, it was so popular that even those snobs out on the East Coast provinces had to go along, and Ottawa made it apply to everybody in Canada. That's how they got there, state by state. And the guy, as I said, the premier of Saskatchewan who started this was a socialist named Tommy Douglas, and he always fought for this and always argued that this was the way to go. Canadians love this system. It exactly fits their egalitarian moral structure. It's fair to everybody, and they love that in Canada. And they love Tommy Douglas. And get this, in 2004, the Canadian Broadcasting Company took a poll. They polled millions of Canadians. Who is the greatest Canadian in history? And the Canadians, the candidates included Wayne Gretzky. Yes, yes. Alexander Graham Bell, they claim him. Pierre Trudeau, who was their JFK, et cetera, et cetera. And the winner was Tommy Douglas, the guy who created Medicare and made health care available to all Canadians. And I've said, I talked to a lot of state legislators, I've said to many legislators, you know, if you would set up a state-run system that worked, you'd be the greatest American in history. You know, it could happen here. And since Washington is not going to get this done, I'll bet you next January there will be bills in 25 state legislatures looking for a way to do this. And, you know, let's have the policy laboratory. Let's try 7 or 8 different measures. Massachusetts tried, and they got to 98% coverage, which is absolutely valuable, but they didn't do anything about costs. They put everybody into these expensive private insurance plans, which is not sustainable on a cost basis. But let other states try. My guess is we will get there state by state. You guys almost did it. Both houses of your legislature passed a bill that would have provided health care for everybody in California. California is often a leader on social policy in the United States. You could do it. Maybe Colorado will beat you to it. But I think state by state, some states will make something work and the rest will see it and it'll work. So I'm now kind of betting on a Canadian model to get to universal coverage in the United States.
I'm Richard Feetcham, and you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is T.R. Reid, Washington Post correspondent and NPR commentator, and he's discussing the contents of his new book, The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. Now, in your book, you clearly fell in love with the British NHS, which not everyone in this audience would share that particular love affair. But I have a question, which is, aren't there private options in the UK which allow more affluent patients to jump the queue?
Yes, there are definitely private options in many countries. There are private options, and Britain has those famous Harley Street doctors in London. They're outside of the NHS. And many people buy private insurance in Britain. Basically, it's usually free because it's so cheap. The NHS takes care of all the big stuff free. So a lot of employers, like even newspapers in Britain, provide private insurance free. You hear that, Washington Post? Because it's cheap. But guess what? People really trust the NHS, and a really small proportion of healthcare spending in Britain goes to the private sector. By some numbers, 3%, 5%. I had a really good friend who worked for the Financial Times. That's Pearson. Pearson's also the publisher of my book, as it turns out, you know, these international conglomerates. And she got free private health care. It's called BUPA. She got free health care and was pregnant. And I said to her, Helen, are you going to go down to the street to the private hospital to have your baby? And she said, no, of course not. She said, I mean, you know, sometimes I use the private care because I can jump the queue. I don't have to wait as long to see a doctor. But no, for something as important as having a baby, I'm going to the NHS. I mean, they really trust the public system more than they do these famous private docs. So they have that system. Some countries, Sweden and Canada, tried to ban this. You know, they're so egalitarian that healthcare, everybody should be in the same system. And you really can't do that because rich people are going to go on a plane and fly somewhere and get treated if they don't anywhere else. So my sense is, fine, let the rich buy their own healthcare. They'll always do it, and that's fine. They'll get good care. Just let's provide a package that covers everybody else.
Much of your book is about what happens in other countries and the relevance of what happens in other countries to the United States. But a number of questioners have pointed out that just a few miles from where we're sitting is the headquarters of an integrated healthcare system that serves a population of 8 million people, which, by the way, is the same as the population of Austria, and that that system has solved many of the challenges of providing high-quality healthcare at reasonable cost that your book describes. And I'm referring, of course, to Kaiser Permanente. It has done this not on foreign soil, but in the same legal and cultural environment as all other healthcare providers and insurers in the U.S. have to operate. Could you comment on whether we might learn more from Kaiser Permanente than from the British National Health Service or the German or the French or the Japanese systems?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and I agree that Kaiser is a good model for American healthcare. But as you say, it only covers 8 million people. I don't know why. They don't operate in every state. They are in Colorado, where I live. And it's a good model, and I think we could learn something from it. I will say this, that, Kaiser is a valuable model. It pays doctors by capitation. That is, it pays you by number of patients, so you have an incentive to keep them healthy rather than to do procedures on them. That would be a useful model. It's operating in the United States. Its costs are significantly higher than any in the other foreign countries that I visited. But yeah, I agree with that. I think it's a successful model to study. In fact, one famous student of healthcare policy, a fellow named Dr. Richard Feacham, did a study arguing that Kaiser is more efficient than Britain's NHS, and that's a very important study. That's really important work.
Well, there is indeed a now a substantial literature comparing quality outcomes and costs between Kaiser and European healthcare systems. And the bottom line conclusion is that Kaiser's performance is superior to most healthcare systems in Europe, and the costs are in fact similar. So Kaiser does have undoubtedly some solutions to offer. And I think the fact that it's done in the American legal and cultural context, where death is optional and litigation is compulsory, is a very important proviso, because Europeans don't live in either of those cultures. There are a number of questions that allude to Congress, members of Congress themselves, having very superior healthcare arrangements and being perhaps heavily influenced by the campaign finance situation and by the activities of unscrupulous lobbyists. Could you comment on whether you think that's a real death knell to significant reform, or whether Congress can rise above those self-interests?
Well, members of Congress have basically access to the same set of health care choices that other federal employees do. And if you happen to be a federal employee in Washington, D.C., you get the broadest list of anybody. I think in the current year, those people can choose among 32 different health insurance providers. I get one choice from my employer. So that's a pretty good deal. And I think this so-called connector, this marketplace that is in the Democratic bills is supposed to be modeled on that insurance companies, in return for getting listed in the marketplace, agree to certain provisions, maximum prices, what they'll cover, et cetera. That's not a bad system at all. The one thing that members of Congress have given themselves, well, two things. If you're in the Capitol at work and you get sick, they have a fleet of doctors down there who treat everybody free. Does that happen at your job? And the members of Congress, of course, can go to Bethesda Naval Hospital to be treated if they choose and don't want to go. Now, nobody else in America has that kind of choice. So they do have a somewhat sweeter deal. But basically, they're in that federal employee health insurance marketplace, which is a terrific marketplace if you happen to live in Washington, D.C. And if we passed a law saying everybody in America gets the same range of choices at the same prices as Congress, we'd be fine. That system would work.
A question about physician salaries, and I think by implication healthcare worker salaries more generally, but particularly physician salaries, pointing out that a specialist, for example, in the United States might on average earn between $400,000 and $600,000 per year, with some earning well above that. Whereas in Canada and European countries, specialist salaries would be half or less than half of that level. What's your view on the significance of physician reimbursement levels as a cost driver? And if it is significant, how would we persuade the medical profession to work for half the income they currently enjoy?
It's a reason for our high costs. American doctors and hospitals are the highest cost in the world. And in my book, I talk to every doctor I visited, how much do you make? And they're pretty plain about it. A, they tell me what they make, and B, they then complain to me they make three times as much if they lived in America, which is arguably true. On the other hand, in most other countries, doctors graduate from medical school with no debt. All over Europe, medical school is free. In Japan, you have to pay for it, but usually the local government pays you to go to medical school. You actually make a salary for going to medical school. And, of course, in other countries, malpractice insurance is minimal and they don't get sued, so they don't have those costs. But still, it is true that American docs make more, and one form of cost control is probably going to be limit compensation, particularly for these most highly paid specialist doctors. Would they put up with that? Yeah, I think they would. I think the doctors I know, I'm on the board of a medical school, and the med students we get, Look, they tend to be people who were good in science and biology in high school and college. They want to use their skill and their talent to help people. And now they're out in a system that just gets in the way. It gets between them and their patients. I think doctors would love to see our system fixed. And most doctors, if you said to them, it's going to require that you make less money, but you'll have a better opportunity to serve your patients, I think most of them would take that deal. Many of them have signed on to that deal. I mean, they signed petitions for this. One of the things we do need to do in our country is we don't have enough primary care doctors. I would say that's family doctors, pediatricians, and general internists. About 35% of American docs are primary care. And if you have half your doctors at primary care or more, it saves a lot of money because those people can do a lot of things that don't have to go to the expensive specialist. Now, get this. Britain, Great Britain, 64% of the doctors are primary care doctors. That's good. How do you get there? A family doc in Britain makes twice as much as a cardiac surgeon. You do that and you solve your problem. Doctors respond to incentives just like everybody else.
That's a very good point. Time is against us, so unfortunately we've come to the very last question, which I think will really challenge you. And it's, given all that you've learned from your travels and your understanding of the challenges that we face in the United States, what would be your strategy, your game plan for moving us, I don't know, incrementally perhaps, or by a big bang, to a system which competes with the best in Europe and in other wealthy countries?
Look, I'm tired of incremental. I've had it up to here with incremental change. Incremental change is what got us in the mess we're in today. It's really time to fix the system. It would be preferable if we could put everybody in America into a single system like we see in other countries. It would be fairer and it would save us tons of money and paperwork. We may not get there, but there are ways to adjust our current system to get everybody covered. And what it takes, as I say over and over in my book, every country I go to, it takes a leader. It takes a national commitment to this moral decision to provide care for everybody. And it takes a leader to lead a country to implement that moral decision. If we could focus our debate not on insurance company reimbursement rates, not on hospital profit levels, but on the fact that many people in America, in the richest country in the world, kids go to bed at night with an earache or with an asthma attack because their parents can't afford a doctor, if we could focus on that and had a leader to do it, I think we could solve our problem. I sure hope so. Thank you very much.
Well, our warm thanks to T.R. Reid, Washington Post correspondent, NPR commentator, and author of what I think is a superb new book, The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the internet, and especially for the tremendously penetrating questions that they've put forward during this session. I'm Richard Feetcham, and I now declare this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, adjourned.